From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, the foreign leaders of Germany and Spain, even the president of the European Union, are calling on the people of France to vote for independent centrist Emmanuel Macron. After yesterday's vote, Macron and Marine Le Pen, the far-right candidate who took over her father's party, will face off in a runoff May 7th, the first time in France in almost 60 years that no candidate will be from a mainstream party or have more than a couple members of their own party in Parliament. That's something we heard from NPR's Eleanor Beardsley this morning. She's back. And Eleanor, give us your reaction to voices across Europe today telling the French how to vote in the runoff.
Well, right. I mean, this race was really a big thing outside of France. People looked at it as, is Europe going to survive? Because if France, a founding and keystone member of Europe along with Germany, left, analysts were saying the bloc would not survive. So Europeans were watching this election closely, and they're just applauding Emmanuel Macron's first place and watching it very closely.
Well, is that going to backfire? I can imagine voters in France don't want to be told what to do.
No, I don't think it's going to backfire. Le Pen will probably try to use it because she will say, you know, Macron is the candidate of globalization. He's the immigrationist. So she'll definitely, you know, play that up. But generally, the French have been pro-European. It wasn't like the British, who always had this strain of anti-EU sentiment.
Yeah. Well, let's back up for people just saying, wait, what happened in France? Because it has been chugging along for a while. There are 11 candidates going into yesterday's first round voting. We have now Macron and Le Pen. Macron, he's been called an outsider, but he was economy minister under the current French president, Hollande. He quit and formed his own movement, En Marche. Forward, onward. What does he represent to voters?
Well, he was more than an outsider. 3 years ago, no one even knew him. And President Hollande just cherry-picked him and made him economy minister. He's a former investment banker. He's a very smart guy. And then he quit after 2 years and formed his own party. People are still pinching themselves, his supporters, that he's here in this place. Part of it was obviously because the mainstream conservative was scandal-ridden, and probably a lot of his supporters went to Macron. Anyway, he represents for people a total change, out with the old, in with not only someone who is not from one of the major parties, but someone who is a generation younger. He's 39 years old, someone who has said, I am pro-Europe, I am pro-business, I want France to be innovative, risk-taking. And so people feel that he has a whole new way of looking at the future. He says he has the way to tackle the problems of the 21st century. The left and right, their solutions don't work anymore. So people really want something new with him.
Yeah. Then you have Marine Le Pen of the National Front Party, her father's party. He made it to a runoff years ago, but he was blatantly racist, anti-Semitic. Her job, we understand, has been to soften that image of her party. Did she do that, or did she, you know, is she still appealing to her father's voters?
She's appealing to her father's voters because it's still the party, but she was very upset by his rhetoric. It was a huge problem. You know, he would make, you know, his anti-Semitic and his xenophobic statements. She expelled him from the party in 2015, and they've had a real rupture. They do not speak anymore, and some people say, oh, it's fake just to make the party look like it's really reformed, but I've talked to people who know them, analysts, and they say, no, this is a real rupture. And so she has made the party more mainstream. She has attracted more women, more regular middle class, you know, lawyers, researchers. I've been to her rallies. They've changed. The people there are completely mainstream, a lot of them. And before that, you would see very angry blue-collar workers, people, you know, with maybe not higher education at her rallies. Now you see all kinds of professionals and just, you know,
well,
business people.
She's still very anti-immigration, very pro-tough stance in
yes.
fighting terrorism. So we'll see how this unfolds.
Very soon, two
yeah.
weeks.
Yeah. So what's happening right now? I mean, are they starting out again?
Round two is starting, and it's starting rough. She has already called Emmanuel Macron, Emmanuel Hollande. She's linking him to the very unpopular, very, you know, considered unsuccessful French president. She says he's the candidate of globalization and immigration and investment bankers and the U.S. banking lobby, and she is the candidate of the people.
So very important issues here, serious consequences to this vote. We know that, Eleanor, but we have to ask. Macron is married to his former high school teacher. In France, I'm sure no one blushes, but we're reading that he wooed her when he was just 15. She was 24 years older. She says she resisted him until he was, I think, 18. She had a husband, three children. She left for him. Does anyone care about that there? Is that an issue?
No, they do. It's very unusual, and it, you know, it raises eyebrows. But she is constantly with him. She was with him last night. They are definitely together. I've actually seen them on the weekend walking in a park holding hands. But this has stirred, rumors that maybe he has a secret other life, and there have been conspiracy theories on the internet. But yes, that's the case. And we're going to have a 63-year-old first lady if he makes it, and he's 39.
Well, let's see. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. Eleanor, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Great to be with you, Robin.
Now to Georgia, where the political battle over the 6th district could become the most expensive House race in history. Last week, Democrat John Ossoff just missed an outright win in a special election to replace now Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. He faces Republican Karen Handel in June 20th runoff that's drawn the money and attention of both national parties and has been called an electoral test for President Donald Trump. And John Ossoff joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Magna, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Well, obviously, there was a lot of excitement around this special election, but I want to talk about the political reality you're facing for the June runoff, because no Democrat has represented the 6th since, 1978? And just a couple of months ago, in the November 2016 election, Tom Price won against his Democratic opponent 62-38%. So don't you expect more Republicans to come out and vote against you in June since they realize what's at stake now?
Well, I think my campaign's strong showing demonstrated the breadth of the coalition that we're building by focusing on local economic development, unleashing Metro Atlanta's economic potential to improve standards of living and create greater economic opportunities for folks here in the area, and by focusing on shared values that unite people in the community here rather than on divisive national politics.
Mm. Point taken, but for example, I was looking at Cobb County, where you took 41.4% of the vote. That's a county where President Trump won by 15%. I mean, how do you expect to make inroads there for June?
Well, I grew up in this district, and it's never been a particularly partisan place. There are folks who want economic opportunity to increase, who want common sense leadership that's focused less on the kind of gridlock and palace intrigue that people are tired of in Washington and more on getting things done. So I'm going to stay focused on local economic development as the highest priority for the campaign.
But again, the 6th has voted Republican for its House representation since 1978. So I'm just wondering how you're going to reach out to those voters who haven't actually voted for a Democrat in a generation.
Well, I've been reaching out to voters across the political spectrum from the very beginning. And I think that that's why I was able to get 48% of the vote in a very crowded field in the first round, was by building that kind of coalition that's sick and tired of the constant R versus D drama and interested in some effective leadership that will deliver results.
Yeah. Well, I want to play a clip from your runoff opponent, Republican Karen Handel. She appeared on CNN's A New Day, and here she is.
The people of this district want a congressman that they know, that they trust. They're not interested in someone who doesn't even live in the district, someone who has a really thin resume and very lacking in experience.
So about that point about you not living in the district, I have heard you in other interviews saying that you are supporting your longtime girlfriend who's a medical student at Emory University, and that once she wraps up her studies at Emory, you're going to move back into the district. But I come back to this point about the stakes being so high. You have the entire apparatus of the Democratic Party in support of you, but you also have the entire apparatus of the Republican Party opposed to you. I mean, you could quash this criticism of you not living in the district right now if you moved back. I mean, why wait? Why not move back to the district now?
Well, what I've committed to Alicia is that while she's concluding her medical training, I'll stand by her side so that she can get to the hospital in the morning and do what she needs to do. And frankly, when I am across the district talking to voters, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, what they're concerned about is what a representative can deliver for this district, not whether I live a mile and a half south of the district boundary. That is a much more important question than geography.
Yeah. With congressional races, there is that political truism that all politics is local, but we're living in a day and age where all politics is national as well. I mean, President Donald Trump lent his voice for a robocall against you. But on the other hand, Samuel L. Jackson did a radio ad backing you. Actress Alyssa Milano and Christopher Gorham even offered to drive voters to the polls for the special election. You don't worry at all, though, that, for example, tweets like this one from National Republican Congressional Committee comms director Matt Gorman, he tweeted, "Nothing says I care about local issues more than flying in Hollywood celebrity." You don't worry that at all that that might resonate with some voters?
I don't think that folks from D.C. coming in and weighing in with typical partisan talking points is what voters here care about. What voters here care about is what will the representative deliver for the district. Metro Atlanta has virtually unlimited economic potential. We've got the busiest airport in the world. We're near a deep water port in Savannah, becoming a hub in the global economy. Dynamic entrepreneurs, growing businesses. That means that Georgia families can see higher standards of living, more affordable college, greater economic opportunity for the next generation. We can all feel the tremendous economic opportunity that this region has in the coming decades. But it's going to take some imagination. It's going to take some energy and some fresh leadership to realize that vision. I think that that and the opportunity that it presents to Georgia families is much more interesting to people here at home than what's going on in Washington. Attack ads, partisanship, negativity, and the same old nonsense.
Well, John Ossoff is the Democratic candidate running for the House seat in Georgia's 6th District. Mr. Ossoff, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure, Magna. Thank you for having me.
And NPR's reached out to Ossoff's Republican opponent, Karen Handel, and hopes to hear back. A president who attacks elites, hates the media, makes claims of election fraud, and faces allegations of having colluded with a foreign government. We're talking about President Richard Nixon, who called the press lousy, dirty, cowardly bastards, claimed a connection with the forgotten man of America, and opened up a back channel to the president of South Vietnam during the Vietnam War. Nixon also claimed to be the law and order candidate in 1968 when he accepted the Republican nomination for the presidency.
To those who say that law and order is a code word for racism, there and here is a reply. Our goal is justice. Justice for every American. If we are to have respect for law in America, we must have laws that deserve respect.
Well, that's a theme that President Donald Trump echoed. Here he is in July at the Republican National Convention.
In this race for the White House, I am the law and order candidate.
Well, this is all part of a new biography of Richard Nixon from biographer and former Boston Globe White House correspondent John Farrell. His book is called Richard Nixon, The Life. And when I spoke with him recently, I started by asking Farrell why a new Nixon book now.
There was a new audience and there was a fire hose worth of fire hydrant worth of new material. It's kind of hard for we baby boomers to deal with, but 2/3 of the American population were either not born or not living in the United States when Richard Nixon left office. And the millennials now are the single biggest generation, and they know Nixon only as a caricature on The Simpsons. So I really wanted to reach out to them and give them one volume that incorporates all the new material that's come out in the last 20 years that they can go to if they have a little bit more interest in the real guy.
Okay, so I want to get to some of the amazing new details that you uncover in the book. But before we do, I mean, we more than intimated that people are talking about Nixon now also vis-a-vis President Donald Trump. I mean, is that a fair comparison to make to our current president?
Somebody said the other day that we've had marches in the streets, allegations of eavesdropping, break-ins at the DNC. It's like we have the Nixon administration on speed dial because it took Nixon 2.5 years to go from Watergate to resignation, and we've had all this in only 6 weeks with Donald Trump. Personally, aside from a certain grandiosity, which is evident on Nixon's tapes and Trump's tweets, they're very different men. But the number of coincidences in their administrations is amazing. And I think also they both have a political way of trying to tap on people's grievances, on the dark side of people, on their fears, racial fears or economic fears or fears about class. And I think that that pretty much sums up their similarities and differences.
I want to get to one of the things which that you uncover in the book, which is just, I mean, it's stunning that nobody really knew, I guess, about Nixon before you published it. And in order to introduce it, I first want to display a little tape. This is from 1969. This is November 1969 when President Richard Nixon is giving a speech on the Vietnam War, and he advocated for troop reductions but a continuation of fighting. So here's President Nixon.
Let historians not record that when America was the most powerful nation in the world, we passed on the other side of the road and allowed the last hopes for peace and freedom of millions of people to be suffocated by the forces of totalitarianism. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
that silent majority speech. But the thing you uncovered is what Nixon did the year before in 1968.
It's a remarkable piece of the puzzle I was able to chance upon in my research. It had always been rumored that Nixon had approached the Nixon campaign had approached the South Vietnamese in October 68 and tried to scuttle Lyndon Johnson's peace initiative by telling them that if they just held on a little bit longer, they would get a better deal when Nixon took office. And indeed, what I found was notes that of a conversation between Nixon barking orders to his chief of staff, H.R. Bob Haldeman, telling them that we got to get work on the South Vietnamese, tell them to drag their feet. We're going to monkey wrench these talks. So, as I said, it had long been rumored that this happened. And in fact, Lyndon Johnson had been tapping the phones of the South Vietnamese embassy and had proof that it was happened. But we never knew, we never could put the words actually in Nixon's mouth. And that was able to do in the book.
This is stunning.
Well, it's for a biographer, it's amazing because it really shows the moral character of the man, that he was willing to put so many lives at stake for this expedient political reason. And you you can't say what would have happened if he hadn't done this, that there would have been peace. You can't make that decision. But we do know that there were so many lives at stake. 2 million Cambodians, 1 million South Vietnamese boat people, and 20,000 more Americans died in Nixon's first term.
I mean— does that not qualify as treason? Am I going too far in saying that? Like he said he's going to scuttle peace talks.
In this conversation that we're having right now about Russiagate and Trump, you will hear something called the Logan Act popped up from time to time. And the Logan Act is this very obscure a law that was passed by the founding fathers, actually. And it says that Americans are not supposed to interfere in the diplomacy of the country with their own private diplomacy. And obviously that's what Nixon did. And it's possible that somebody on the Trump team did that as well, interceding with the Russians last fall.
Huh. Well, I mean, we could spend our whole time just talking about Vietnam and Nixon. But there are so many other fascinating aspects about his presidency and about his approach to power, right? Nixon famously hated the press, right? He may not have ever, I mean, he didn't have Twitter, but I don't think he actually ever, did he ever utter his disdain for the press as President Trump has had?
Almost word for word. There's a famous quote from Nixon on the tapes where he says, "Henry, write this down. The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy."
But he said that privately, though.
He said that privately. Yeah. The tapes and the tweets to me are like, they're both glimpses into presidential ids. And so that's the comparison that I like to make. But it's true. Nixon was, he would go to a press conference towards the end of his term and actually say, you know, don't think that you people out there have gotten me angry, because in order to be angry, you have to respect the person who's going to get you angry. So he was pretty icy with the press, but he never went as far as to try to convince the American people that the press is the enemy of the American people.
You know, we are, I think, rightfully spending time on many of the highly controversial aspects of President Nixon's tenure in the White House. But, I mean, you also do write about some of his accomplishments, right? Like that he signed into law increases for Social Security, a 20% jump under Nixon, more money for education. He declared war on cancer, asked Congress to double arts funding. Also, maybe people don't realize this, but he had a significant environmental legacy as well. The National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act. He established, you know, other environmental major landmarks in the United States. So these aren't things that we usually associate with Nixon as a president.
No. The major environmental groups were polled several years back about who was the greatest green president, and they came in with Teddy Roosevelt first and Nixon second. He established the EPA, and it's sort of ironic to see this fellow who's president now, who says to be an admirer of president, dismantling the environmental protection. But the phrase that I use continually in the book is "and yet," because for almost everything despicable at Nixon, you can find something that's laudatory as well. And he invented, or his administration invented, affirmative action. And his administration was the biggest desegregator of Southern schools. And yet, He was also the creator of the Southern strategy that gave the South, through a thinly disguised racism, over to the Republican Party. So a very controversial character. It was a lot of fun making my way through those different alleyways of his mind.
Well, I want to play one more piece of tape, because regardless of President Nixon's accomplishments, I think there's pretty much one moment which in the mind, popular mind of the United States, defines him.
People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
That came after a particularly awkward moment. And Nixon actually established sort of the precedent of presidents showing their income tax returns, which Donald Trump has now dashed. But it was turned out that Nixon had taken a $400,000 tax break on his vice presidential papers that had been backdated by an aide, and he had to answer questions about that. You're right. But his final closing speech before he left the White House to get on the helicopter to go away, where he talks about never hate people because once you hate them, then they've won and you destroy yourself, is just a wonderful, moving piece of Americana as well. So very complex guy. He doesn't fit easily into today's left and right. He sort of floats all by himself like an asteroid in space, and the Democrats will never forgive him, and the right has never adopted him since Reagan.
So let me ask you. I mean, of course, there's also Watergate, and that another famous phrase: "Cover up is worse than the crime."
Yep.
How much does how Americans' attitudes about the presidency were transformed by Richard Nixon inform how we view all the tumult going on with the Trump presidency right now?
Absolutely. Nixon's downfall and the government investigations that followed, the Church Committee, showed a tremendous amount of wrongdoing by Americans' presidents. And this great faith that they had put in the presidency during the Cold War sort of frittered away. I would say that we're returning to that right now. I don't know what the Trump people have done, but they're acting like they have something that they want to cover up, just like Nixon.
Well, the new biography is Richard Nixon, A Life. It's by John A. Farrell. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Glad to be here.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week, change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/here. Go now and get your first three meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
And it's the spring home buying season, and sales are up. Existing home sales had their strongest month in a decade in March, but the number of homes on the market is down. Inventory has been falling for nearly 2 years, and that's pushing prices up. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money, and her new podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So first explain what's happening. Why is inventory so low?
Well, there are definitely a bunch of factors. The most important one is that early in the housing market recovery, we saw these big private equity funds, you know, big rich folks pulling together money and scooping up tons of real estate, single family homes. They bought up all these distressed properties, they fixed them up, and then what they did was they rented them out, finding that, wow, they were really able to collect a lot of money in the rental market. Normally they might flip those properties and book a quick profit, but instead those properties have remained off the market, and that's really constrained inventory.
Okay, so there's not as many houses, so that's driving the prices up, but people are buying homes. So I'm guessing it's people who have money on hand, and that's probably not first-time home buyers.
Well, right. We're having a little bit of a problem in the first-time home buyer market because there's two things that are happening, right? We have a lot of people who were able to move up. They had equity in their homes, their existing homes, and then they were able to take that equity, use it to buy their next home. And because there was a good bid right there for their existing home, they could sell it, use the equity, hurrah, I've got a new house. And of course, the economy improving and more jobs created, credit scores improving, all of this contributed. But again, that low inventory is putting quite a bit of pressure on prices, and that is keeping a lot of those would-be first buyers out of the market or kind of bummed out. Like, they look for a really long time for a house, and then they say, oh, forget it, I'll just keep renting.
Well, and as usual, it's the baby boomers' fault.
Yeah,
because
well, right.
They're not, blame everything on the, because they're not getting out of the market.
Right. And this is so fascinating because I talk to a lot of boomers on my podcast and on my radio show, and they literally are saying, well, I'm not giving up that 3.25% 30-year fixed rate mortgage, are we? Am I, right? Or they're saying, you know, this is not like my retirement. I don't see myself moving to a community. What I'd like to do instead would be to move to what they call age in place. So maybe make changes in my existing home, keep it really nice, but not move. And again, that is actually constraining inventory.
Yeah. So what's your advice to someone buying a home right now?
Well, first of all, you've got to be patient. And my mother, who is a realtor, is very fond of saying, a house is like a man. There's more than one for you in the world. Now, that said, for her lesbian daughter, that's a little bit tough. But now, you've got to be patient. You've got to run the numbers also, right? You really have to be careful that you are buying what you can afford. We learn this lesson time and time again. But, you know, when there's not a lot of inventory, you start reaching maybe for something you can't afford. Be sure to get that credit report. Really have to correct any errors on that report. Conduct your research, even if you're working with a realtor. Check out those new listings. Spread the word throughout your network. You never know where a listing is going to come from.
Right. And we're going to be watching housing this week. A lot of data coming out tomorrow. Case-Shiller Home Price Index. New housing starts will be released. Thursday pending home sales will be released. Jill Schlesinger, who we just love and always enjoy, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Say hi to your mom, and thank you so much.
Take care.
There's been a national conversation about Confederate symbols, from the flag itself to Ivy League schools facing questions about past slave-holding school officials. In New Orleans, there's been a two-year-long open debate over removing Confederate-era monuments. The city council approved removal 6-1, but the actual removal is being done under cover of darkness. Overnight, one of four prominent Confederate-era statues was taken down and carted away by a crew of workers wearing masks and bulletproof vests, with nearby roads closed and rooftop snipers watching over them. After it was over, New Orleans Democratic Mayor Mitch Landrieu, who helped launch the effort, said this.
I believe more strongly today than ever that in New Orleans we should truly remember all of our history, not some of it. And that means we will no longer allow the Confederacy to literally be put on a pedestal in the heart of our city.
Tim Morris, opinions columnist at the New Orleans Times-Picayune, has been following this. Tim, start with a question you seem to be posing in a column. Why all this secrecy? But then you tell us last year a company that was hired to take down these monuments quit after its employees received death threats.
Yeah, it became a very emotional issue from the very beginning. People who were considering bidding for the contract said they received threats, some death threats, and others that were threatened that their businesses might be boycotted by those who were opposed to the removal of the monuments. So it's become a very tense situation.
Yeah. Well, and so much so that the actual contractor who did this work overnight covered over the name of the company on their trucks. Tell us about what seems to be the most controversial, this obelisk that honors the Crescent City White League. Who were they, and what's the history of this monument?
Well, this was a reconstruction, a monument to an issue that happened during Reconstruction, and that was, you know, state government, city government. You now had African Americans who were now part of that, and there was a riot that broke out, and this White League battled the Integrated Police Department, and several people were killed, and later on the monument was put up basically just in memorial to the white people who died and not the black police officers and others. Of the four monuments, it was in the least conspicuous place and is the one that very few people actually defend.
Well, we read this Liberty Place monument in 1891 honored the Crescent City White League. Somebody added an inscription in 1932 saying that the Yankees withdrew federal troops and recognized white supremacy in the South.
And then in 1993, those words were covered by a granite slab with a new inscription saying that it honors Americans on both sides. Well, what about the statues of the Confederate generals Robert E. Lee and P.G.T. Beauregard and Confederate President Jefferson Davis, also scheduled to come down? Remind us how revered they still are by some in the area.
So P.G.T. Beauregard is actually, you know, a native here and has some connection. And people talk about how when he came back after the Civil War, he actually worked for Reconstruction and made an effort for healing. The statue shows him in his Confederate uniform on a horse. Jefferson Davis actually died here and was buried here for a brief time, but then was later moved. But he made visits to New Orleans. Robert E. Lee, whose statue is in Lee Circle, which is a very prominent place in New Orleans, actually I don't think ever came to visit here, and there were no major battles that he was involved in the Civil War for it. So, but people still see, obviously, especially Lee, they see him as a who they think was an honorable man, even though he clearly fought for the wrong side. I don't know that people think about them or thought about them a lot before this all came up, but I think there are people who said this is our history and we should know about it and maybe in some ways celebrate it. And while there are others who say, yes, this is our history, but it's a part of history in which some of these men should not be celebrated and should not have statues in a place where there's really no context for it.
Well, there was a candlelight vigil by supporters, we understand, last night. And here's what Mayor Landrieu said to those who might be feeling the way you just described.
But relocating these Confederate monuments is not about taking something away from someone else. This is not about politics. It's not about blame. It's not about retaliation. This is not a naive quest to solve all of our problems at once. This is about showing the whole world that we as a city and as a people are able to acknowledge, understand, reconcile, and most importantly, choose a better future, making straight what has been crooked and right what has been wrong.
Mayor Landrieu there. But you write about the lack of transparency around taking them down. Why? What would you like to see?
Well, partly because of the reasons of safety, they've taken certain steps. But we really haven't had a discussion about what's going to happen to these statues. There's been discussion about putting them in a museum, but there's really no definitive statement from the city as to how that's going to look and where that's going to be. And there are people who are concerned that they're just going to be either put away in a warehouse or actually destroyed. And without the transparency of saying, okay, here's what we're going to do, here are the next steps, here's where they're going to end up, people are suspicious. It may all work out, but the fact that the city has not explained that, they're being removed with private donations by a person we don't know. The name has not been released, and there's no plans to do that. So I think it leads to skepticism from people who were already emotionally involved in the removal.
Well, and in the process itself, it sounds as if perhaps I hear the fear of some sort of danger for workers, but it feels as if the city might have missed out on what seemed like a very cathartic moment for people in South Carolina, for instance, when the lowering of the flag was very public there.
And there was a push by a group called Take 'Em Down to say, let's do this out in the public. And, you know, I think that would be better. You're right. There would be some closure. It looks bad, I think, for a government to do something under the cloak of darkness and to have to go to such secrecy. I think it would be a much better moment for the public if we all saw them coming down and having them removed in a way in which the city could come together on.
Tim Morris, opinions columnist at the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Tim, thanks for talking to us about this change in your city landscape. Thank you.
Thank you.
Turning to London now, where a record number of runners, nearly 40,000, completed yesterday's London Marathon. Hundreds of thousands of spectators cheering them on and treated to a record performance by the winner of the women's race. Here and Now's marathon man Alex Ashlock is in London and filed this report.
The 37th London Marathon gets underway. It could be the greatest ever.
The BBC announcer called it just about right at the start. It was the greatest ever for Kenyan runner Mary Kitani. Encouraged by the spectators as she neared the finish line, she ended up running the fastest marathon ever in a women's only race, 2 hours, 17 minutes, and 1 second. Hilton Whittle, visiting from South Africa, watched the runners cruising along the Thames River and was impressed by Kitani's performance.
I thought the women's leader was running magnificently, so it's steady and easy.
Just like last Monday's Boston Marathon, London's marathon was a Kenyan sweep. Daniel Wanjiru won the men's race here in 2 hours, 5 minutes, and 56 seconds. In the wheelchair races, Brit David Weir won his hometown race for the 7th time, also a new record. And Switzerland's Manuela Schaar, who won the Boston Marathon a week ago today, also won London's marathon yesterday. There was heavy security for the race. In fact, the Sunday Times called it the biggest anti-terror operation in the 37-year history of the London Marathon. Concrete and steel barriers were placed across roads close to the course to stop cars or trucks from trying to run down spectators, attacks that have happened recently in France, Germany, and even here in London last month on Westminster Bridge. Police were armed and had shoot-to-kill orders if they spotted a terrorist driver. But the race went off without incident. Among the runners, there were Vikings, elves, and monks, and the oldest competitor, 83-year-old Ken Jones, who completed his 37th consecutive London Marathon. Also, about a dozen members of Parliament ran the marathon. Today, though, it's back to a different kind of race, the campaign for the snap election on June 8th. They might find the marathon was a bit easier. There's a bit of election fatigue here. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock in London.
Former President Barack Obama today made his first public remarks after leaving office. He spoke at the University of Chicago, talking about the importance of civic engagement to a few hundred area college students. Six of those young people joined Obama on stage. Here's a bit of what he said.
What I'm convinced of is that although there are all kinds of issues that I care about and all kinds of issues that I intend to work on, the single most important thing I can do is to help in any way I can prepare the next generation of leadership to take up the baton and to take their own crack at changing the world.
Obama's appearance comes just days before President Donald Trump marks his first 100 days in office. Joining us now from Chicago is Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent. Hi there, Tamara.
Hi there.
Well, first of all, there's a custom amongst former presidents to not comment on the current occupant of the White House. Did President Obama follow that custom?
Yes. There were no mentions of the current president that I detected. There was not even really any backhanded, subtle mentions of the current occupant of the White House. Former President Obama was very focused on what the young people on stage had to say about involvement in their communities. He wanted to talk about, you know, improving civic engagement and at one point talked about the challenges of American politics in this social media age. But he did not talk about the current occupant of the White House.
Yeah, it's interesting. The times we live in, even if he didn't say anything, one can maybe tangentially see everything he says as a commentary, even if President Obama doesn't mean it. But he's been out of the limelight for several months, and he chose to speak to young people in Chicago. Why that audience?
There are a number of reasons for that. One is that he will be building his library and center here near the University of Chicago, in relation with the University of Chicago. And he specifically, as he said in that clip of tape that you played, is interested in the next generation of American civic leaders and the next generation of people who would get involved in politics like he did. He also, during this event, talked about something that he did yesterday in Chicago that was not open to the press and did not get the same sort of publicity as this event in an auditorium, but where he met with young men who have been on the wrong side of the law. He said some of them had already been shot more than once, and they're very, you know, they're all in their early 20s and late teens, and he talked about that experience as a way of sort of bridging the divide, that if those young men had been up on the stage as opposed to the young people that were on the stage who were, you know, top of their class, that there would be more that they had in common than they had that was different.
Oh, interesting. Well, as you mentioned, Tamara, President Obama also talked about political division and the impact of the internet and that as a force in dividing Americans. Let's listen to a little bit more of what he said, specifically about the impact of the internet on empathy.
Even within the city boundaries, a lot of times we will characterize our neighbors, as something entirely different than us, that we can't understand and that we're afraid of and that we can't communicate with, and political rhetoric reinforces that. And they need to be heard too.
So, Tamara, tell us more about this line of speaking that that President Obama had.
Yeah, he had questions for the young people who were up on stage with him about how they felt that these sort of divides could be bridged. I don't think anyone came away from this discussion with answers to that question, though the youngest woman on the stage, a young girl who's still in high school, suggested, well, maybe we should just get rid of social media. And then she was like, wait, correction, I don't think I can say that. But, you know, there are not easy answers to these problems. He also talked about how institutions in this country have been are on the decline, that things like unions or churches, that membership in organizations that bring people together across some of these ideological divides is down, that you know, that we are more isolated than we've been. So a lot of questions, not a lot of answers coming from the former president today.
Huh, interesting. Well, I want to play one more piece of tape, because one of the students that was there at the event had been working with a group of day laborers and asked President Obama's advice about how to get them to trust him, which raised that larger issue of immigration. And here's what Obama said.
Your ability to create trust and relationships is the thing that makes all the difference in being able to have an impact. And that's hard to do in this current environment, but it's not impossible.
So can we expect more appearances like this in the coming months?
He will be making more appearances, not necessarily at universities, not necessarily with young people, but he has a couple of things booked. And you know, he also did mention that he is working on a book,
yeah,
which is not something that can really be done in public.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith in Chicago, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
This is Here and Now.